You're listening to the Concierge Coaches Show with Bruce Cameron and Justin Nimmergood, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of the Concierge Coaches Show here on LA Talk Radio. I'm Bruce Cameron along with Justin Nimmergood.
Happy Monday, everyone, and happy Monday to you, Bruce. Hope you had a good weekend.
Had a good weekend. All kinds of things happening in there in the news and around, and some news items that are actually peripherally related to our guest we're going to have on here in just a few moments. I've been following that Jeffrey Epstein case very closely, you know.
Oh yeah. As have we. It's definitely a dicey one, depending on where you fall on the spectrum.
Yeah, I think I performed over 1,100 suicide watch evaluations in 24 years for the Federal Bureau of Prisons. And, man, you know, it's when somebody's on, you know, he wasn't on suicide watch, but I think his cellmate had left and transferred out, and I think some things happened in those moments where he was unattended, but certainly, sex offenders as a group are obviously at a higher risk of suicide, but boy, this individual was what they call in the Federal Bureau of Prisons a broad publicity case, you know, and so we could almost compare and contrast him and Bill Cosby, why Bill Cosby stayed as a state case versus a federal case. We won't necessarily get into that because this isn't a law show. But anyway, the whole notion of what happens to perpetrators. But we're not going to talk about perpetrators today. we're going to talk about the other end of that, surviving that. And as well as addiction and moving forward and, you know, spreading hope and actually coaching other folks that have empowering women and men that have been through some traumatic experiences. So,
Yeah. And I think, you know, as coaches, it's our duty to really tap into this side of it. You do this regularly with your clients, and I do in my own way. Obviously, I more lightly, I would say, do it, you know, from a business perspective, but sometimes you need to get in there and do some rewiring work with them. But this is so essential, right? I mean, this is core and foundational to anyone's not only success, but their overall happiness. And I think we all have our own traumatic events, experiences that have accrued through our lifetime. So, should be a really exciting topic for our listeners today.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting because a lot of people that have been affected with certain types of trauma or even sexual trauma may not go to somebody with credentials like mine, regardless of my gender. They might not go to a psychotherapist or a counselor or whatever, because look, there's nothing wrong. I mean, I'm a survivor. There's nothing wrong with me. I mean, and so they will go to a coach, right? So some folks would rather go to a coach, go to a mentor, go to someone who has been through a similar experience. You know, they don't necessarily want to go to a third party professional or when I also mean third party by somebody who, you know, hasn't done it. I worked 6 years in a women's prison, and for the life of me, I can only relate so much on what it feels like to have a baby and give birth to a child. I mean, you know what I mean? I've delivered babies in prison. I've been there for my own, but you know what? I can't, right? I just can't get my hand around some of the pain and things involved with that, because I just haven't done that. And I think in the field of trauma and addiction, that can make a difference for many folks if you have kind of been there. I know in coaching that works for you, I mean, because people see what you've done in business, Justin, and
right.
your pedigree and where you've come from, what you're doing, and how you do it and how you get out there. And so you're literally teaching your clients something, a skill that you have yourself, right?
Yeah, that's true. And I think you bring up another good point that I think is important before I know we have a great guest on for today, but you know, the coaching versus therapy, you know, routes and you know, I think it's important to note. Actually, it's funny, you know, I went through some the last couple months, you know, Naomi and I have done some pre-marriage counseling of our own. But it's interesting when you go through that, you see that if it's not a coach, if it's not someone from sort of a coaching background and perspective, I instantly saw the delineation point, right, of, you know, listening and treating versus like treating it like a project, I guess, and trying to get at the root solution, which is what I feel like us coaches really get at. So, again, interesting for the listeners out there, you know, just tune into that, right? As with every episode, you know, you'll find that our guests and us, we try to come from a place of really getting at root causes, pain points, and uncovering those and trying to rid people of root causes and problems and traumas, and not just, you know, giving a band-aid solution, so to speak.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, well, what I'd like to do is I'd like to, you know, bring on our guest. You know, our guest today is Donna Speer, and she, an actress, model, a recovery specialist. She has been in several movies, many different movies. She also got recovery from substances, age 23. She's also been Playboy centerfold, and she has 32 years of, you know, she's clean and sober 32 years. She's mentored hundreds of women through the addiction recovery process. She founded one of the first no charge recovery detox centers for women in California, Lynn House. And I believe you're still on the board for that house. And she was selected Woman of the Year for the Yellowstone Foundation, which is a nonprofit women's recovery group of homes. And so without further ado, Donna, thank you for coming on with us today.
Thank you, Bruce. Thank you, Justin, for having me. I really appreciate being able to come in today. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I know
it's our pleasure.
You have a new book out as well, The Naked Truth. We want to be able to talk about that. Of course, we're, you know, obviously we're going to run out of time. So we want to, you know, I want to underscore some of the parts of your story to our listeners. And also kind of for my own curiosity as well, we've had the pleasure of talking and speaking for a couple of months now. And so, again, we really appreciate you spending your time. I know things are kind of crazy now with the book out and you're doing a lot of media, right?
It has been crazy. You know, I just got off book tour and I'm settling back into my coaching again. And, you know, with all the work I do with women as well, I mean, I have completely had my hands full and I've been blessed with the ability to give back what I've been so freely given. And I do appreciate having time to share good messages on the Concierge Coaches show, and as well as being around you two who are two amazing coaches as well. I mean, I'm in good company. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Well, let me kind of get right into the matter here. You've talked about, and again, folks, this is publicly available in your book and everything, but you talked about being involved with Bill Cosby at around age 16. Can you talk a little bit about the circumstances? Were you part of the motion picture industry at that time, or kind of talk how you got into his company and how maybe some of that grooming might have started, if you can?
Absolutely. That's part of my story in The Naked Truth, The Fall and Rise of Donna Speer in my book. And you know, I didn't come out with that until after Mr. Cosby had been arrested and sentenced. So that's one thing I want to add in there. I was part of the grooming process as a child, and I was a child actress in my model. And he was one of the girls that he mentored, and I was a juvenile. You know, it was years before technology and the internet, and I was very vulnerable. I was a young girl, and my parents were much older when they had me. And he persuaded my parents as well as me to get caught up in his web. And I don't know if you, Bruce, if you ever, or Justin, if you ever saw Neverland documentary on HBO. But basically, that is exactly what he did to me and my parents. He showered us with many gifts and large-scale trips, and not only my parents, but my entire family. And that is how I was able to hide under the guise of his mentorship. I mean, he went as far as to hire McCann and Erickson, which was the largest public relations firm in New York City at the time, to do a huge Coca-Cola advertising billboard campaign around me at the time. I mean, huge money, huge, huge money.
Right. And so that creates a cognitive dissonance, right? Here's a guy of power and authority. He's investing in you. He's investing in your family. And therefore, the default is that he's trusted, or he should be trusted.
And he very much was trusted. I mean, he was the spokesperson for Coca-Cola at the time. He had two children shows on television at the time. And furthermore, he was 26 years my senior. So he was trusted. And also, one of the things you need to remember is that pedophiles, most people think, now they're a little bit more informed, but back then pedophiles were always thought of as a man pulling up in a car who would snatch your child and run off, which is absolutely true, or a pedophile was a man in a coat who was a flasher, which is also true. But mostly a lot of people that are pedophiles are someone that the family knows and trusts. Right. And they work their way into your family, such as the neighbor, an uncle, the Cub Scout leader, the Girl Scout leader, someone that knows your family and works their way into the family system.
That's you're right. And I kind of want to even drill down further. And I'm curious again, because, you know, I'm in the field. I treat perpetrators and speak on this topic a lot.
Correct.
There's the pedophile is the person who really preys upon children. There's this other variety of sex offender called a hebephile. Mm-hmm. And that's the one that really kind of comes in at the 11, 12, 13 range.
Right.
Was Mr. Cosby, as you say, was he seeing you in the pedophile range, or were you more in the tween, preteen zone when he finally began this boundary violating behavior?
Okay, so I would say actually I was 16 when I met him. I had just turned 16, so I would say I was a young girl. I was actually like Jeffrey Epstein age.
Oh, okay. Interesting categorization there, but yes, okay. And you know, because there's Tanner scales and there's other things that we use in terms of the anatomical features of the victim, et cetera. But again, not wanting to get into that. So he had worked his way in and showered you all with, like you said, prosperity and opportunity and notoriety and appearance. How long were you involved with him at a physical, close proximity, physical level, would you say?
On and off for almost 2 years.
2 years. Okay. Mm-hmm. 2 years. And so can you discuss the bridge between that and then your emerging or your developing substance use battle? Do you think that fueled was the origin of it? Or
so what I can share with you was I was actually being molested before I met Mr. Cosby, and when it started when I was 14, 15 by somebody else. And so by the time I got away from the gentleman, I fell into the hands of Mr. Cosby.
Wow.
What I can tell you is that I was primed for a predator at an early age. I had very low self-esteem. I was not close with my family. I didn't have hobbies. I didn't have many sports. I was the last child of six at home. My parents were tired. My mom had a mental disease, so she wasn't on top of me all the time. What I can tell you is that I believe I was born an alcoholic drug addict. So my drug addiction really started to roar before Cosby. And suicide attempts started happening before Bill and all those things. When I got away from that first man, they slowed down. So by the time I met Bill, I had stopped with some very heavy drug abuse. Okay. When I got with Bill, I started drinking very heavily. But then the drug abuse kicked in again because of the secrets. What I do know is that the trauma that I got into during that whole time fueled the drug abuse, fueled the alcohol addiction because of the secrets and shame that it carried. So did one affect the other? I think it was a cycle.
Do you think your self-esteem, by the time you had met Mr. Cosby, was your self-esteem wounded to the point that you might have felt like you were damaged goods or
absolutely
something?
I was damaged goods by then. Absolutely. And he knew that. Absolutely picked up on it.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So, okay. Yeah, thank you for being candid with me. And you know, I'm always right to the point.
Oh, absolutely.
These are all the questions I didn't get a chance to ask you on our prior.
No, it's, you know what? That's not a problem at all. Yeah. Bruce. You know, one of the things in my book that I share, Naked Truth, The Fall and Rise of Donna Spear, is I am very, very upfront. And I wrote the book for women and men because sexual abuse happens on both of them, and drug addiction and alcoholism, it seems to go really hand in hand with sexual abuse from what I have found. Now I'm wrong on a lot of times.
No.
But I am very, very candid about my sexual abuse and about my drug and alcohol addiction because it's time to take the shame and the guilt out of the victim.
Absolutely.
And I carried that for years and years. And that's one of the things that I work on with my coaching, drug addiction and the sexual abuse, is that to drop the shame and to take, you know, once we take the shame into the light, it disappears. And by owning it and saying this happened to me, it's just such a big relief, and that we just don't have to carry it around anymore. And we can lift our heads up and say, you know what? Look, I'm perfectly imperfect. This is what happened to me, and it's okay. And so I really write about that in the book, and it's all right. It's all right. We get on with our lives.
Fantastic. And in that vein, I've been really inviting, you know, coaches and people that I talk to in this space and cousin type spaces to really talk about some of those first steps. And so I want to do the same thing with you now in terms of, okay, so after the relationship, or the, not, excuse me, whatever happened.
Right. It's a tricky space.
I should say.
Right. It's okay.
So after Mr. Cosby, now you got clean at 23. Can you talk about those first months and years of your mental process as you became to get sobriety and then keep it and sustain it and then maintain it? I mean, I know many people find help through the 12 steps and, et cetera, but I really want to drill down to the thinking, regardless of the guidepost or the moral compass. But can you share some of your thinking those first months or even year or 2 years, coming up into your sobriety and how you did that mentally?
It was very, very difficult. My thinking was very askew, and I didn't have any idea how crazy I was. So at the age of 23, when I got clean and sober, I want you to know my relationship with men was so insane. At the age of 21, I was on my second and a half marriage. Okay. Because I was looking for something to fix me. And when I say second and a half, my first marriage was 42 days. My second marriage, I got married in Mexico, and had the man not died, I am probably still married in Mexico. And my third marriage, I met a man at church because I was looking for something to fix me outside of myself. So by the age of 23, I'm married to a man I absolutely hate. He absolutely hates me. And I'm now married to this guy, and my life is in utter turmoil, and I'm drinking around the clock, and it's absolutely terrible. I'm a Playmate centerfold, and I'm making movies, and from the outside, I'm beautiful, and I'm young, and it looks like I'm living in Newport Beach, Justin, so you can probably relate to this, where the beautiful people live, and I'm in the society column, and we look like, he looks like Ken, and I look like Barbie, and from the outside, we look perfect. You know, it's the 80s, and we've got two Porsches, and we have the house, and everything's going right from the outside, and I am dying inside. Absolutely dying.
Wow.
And then you were sick and tired of being sick and tired. What, talk about the turnaround from that then.
It wasn't exactly that pretty. It wasn't that pretty at all, Bruce. I wish I just woke up one morning and said, gosh, you know, I think I'll just quit drinking that day. You know, it doesn't quite right. happen like that. What happened was I hit him with the car drinking that night, and the next day I had to get sober. But
all right.
That's really what happened.
Wow.
Nice. My first year was very, very hard because back in the 80s, people didn't get sober, and especially at the age of 23 years old.
Very uncool. Yes.
Very, very uncool. I mean, I don't even remember if Betty Ford was there then.
You know,
I'm running around the Playboy Mansion, and, you know, I'd done a lot of wreckage in Newport Beach. But what I know was I needed to get sober or I was going to die. And I knew that. I knew that my drinking was not a habit anymore, and I was hurting a lot of people, and I had a lot of secrets, and they were killing me. And, you know, what I do know is that it was necessary for me to get brutally honest with myself and the people around me, and they knew I had a drinking problem.
Now, how did you join a 12-step group? Who were the first responders helping you out of your hole here?
It was a 12-step group, and honestly, it was a bunch of really old people that I didn't like, and I didn't get sober because I wanted to. I got sober because I needed to, and it was a 12-step group, and, you know, it was a bunch of really old ladies, and they'd been sober longer than I'd been alive, and I didn't like them, and I don't know how willing I was to do what they said, but I did it out of necessity to live.
Wow.
To be honest, that's how willing I was. It was brutal. It was brutal for me. I think the only thing I did right those first few years was I didn't drink and I was honest.
Did you have a sponsor? Did you have accountability?
I had a sponsor, and I went to a lot of meetings. And, you know, and that first few years, you know, you got to remember, I mean, I was under a 7-picture contract. And I made 6 more films those next few years, and I'm flying all over the world, and I'm opening up films in Japan, and I'm going to South America, and I'm flying to Canada, and I'm all over the United States modeling, and I'm trying to stay sober. You know,
I looked at your IMDb, and I've seen some of the media and the pictures, you know what I mean, the movie poster type of things. And were you kind of like, were your handlers at the time trying to make you like a Farrah Fawcett? What genre were you trying to, you know what I mean? It's interesting. You know what I mean? Cause and it could be just the hair. We love Texas hair in Texas, and Farrah had the Texas hair. So,
I was an 80s girl. I was a California 80s girl. Yeah.
All right. We'll just call it that then.
Right.
But yeah, like you said, you're under a multi-year contract, so you're kind of at the whims of your contract, right? I mean,
yeah,
you have a lot of freedom.
I had
brutal.
It was rough, and I'm on the sets and people are asking me, you know, and I'm going to 12-step meetings while I'm on the sets and I'm leaving and going to meetings, and it was not a cool thing. And, you know, I used to be the party girl and now I'm the outcast, and I just knew what I knew I had to do to stay alive. And it wasn't like people on the sets back then were in 12-step meetings. And so I just continued to do what I did, and, but, you know, I'm just really grateful I was able to stay sober all these years. And, you know, as it turned around that, you know, back in Orange County is where the Lynn House I opened up years ago, and it's still open as of this day. Over 2,000 women have gone through that home.
That's fantastic.
Wow.
That's fantastic. What year did you open? What year did it open?
I think it was a long time ago. It was before we moved to Northern California. I think it was around 2000, okay. I'm thinking 2003 or
so,
or 5 or something. Yeah, isn't that sad? I can't remember.
I do want to go back a little bit. So you got clean at 23. Mm-hmm. You're maintaining your sobriety. You're still, though, under the auspices of a 7-year contract where it seemingly, and I'm a third party male here, seemingly you're cast in these kind of, I guess, sexy roles to some degree. Thank you. Good way of putting it.
That's okay. It is what it is. Honestly, I don't hide what I did. You
know? So how were you able to, your self-esteem and your image of yourself, I mean, how were you able to kind of come out of the abuse mode, surviving mode, into this long contract, still in sexy? Do you say to yourself, okay, this is just a job, it's a vocation? There's limits on, you know.
Right. So
how did you rectify that? Yeah.
This is interesting because if you look at my book and what I did, I was a walking contradiction. So I know because I was a centerfold and I did all these TNA films and, you know, I did all the posters and bikinis and all that. And a lot of people go, well, how can this be? The truth of the matter is here it is. So I worked in LA. I lived in Orange County. What I did for a living was not who I was. Who I was was a sober woman helping other women. What I did was how I paid my rent. And the truth be, it wasn't until I was in my 30s, actually like 34, 35, that I even started recognizing the sexual abuse.
Wow.
It wasn't until it became a problem for me. And it wasn't until after I got married and had a child that I started recognizing the abuse in my life and even started admitting it, that it was a problem. I had swept it under the carpet so deep. So I never really correlated the two, that maybe they were an issue. Because I didn't have a lot of boundaries because I was the girl who always got married. I was always the bride, never the bridesmaid. I didn't realize I had father issues or mother issues or any of those things until after I had a child. And that's when I dug deeper and realized maybe some of the issues I've had in my life had to do with the sexual abuse. So it wasn't until I was years and years sober that I even picked up the shovel and looked at some of those issues.
And the impetus for that was having your own child and through protection of your own child that those issues.
Part of it, yes. Realizing that I had an innocent little child. That was part of it, yes.
What was the other part, you think?
You know, I just couldn't push down some of the feelings of insanity, some of the feelings of what is still wrong with me, some of the shame, some of those different things. And I get into that in the book. You know, it took a long time for me to get the person I was. So just because I got sober and quit using drugs doesn't mean I became a whole person. You know, as we go through our coaching with people, right, it takes a while to progress. It's not like we just get well and whole right away.
Just because you're abstinent, right.
Right. You know, I had a very slow recovery. And I wish that upon all people who get sober, a very slow recovery. See, in my coaching, a lot of times I don't necessarily work with women who are right out of recovery. Sometimes I do as their aftercare plan, but a lot of times I'll work with people who are stuck in their recovery, who can't get through to the next level into certain places. Justin, I kind of look at what you do. You know, sometimes we work with people who need a little boost into the next level in their life, correct?
Yes.
Right.
Right.
Absolutely.
So they need that little push into the next level. Their business is stuck, and they need that push into the next level of making their business or their strategy into their next level of making money, or they're stuck somewhere.
So in your coaching, you know, we're talking about coaching. We're helping remove self-limiting beliefs. But also, if you're partnering with somebody as their coach and they're in recovery, and if they're active in a 12-step paradigm, you kind of say, hey, you know, we humbly asked him to remove these defects in character. Sometimes, you know, I mean, is some of your work looking at some of those character issues that are really inhibiting the person from their growth and their recovery?
Or helping them find them that they're unaware that they've had all these years.
Okay.
You know, even 10 years in recovery, they may not be able to see them yet.
Good point.
And that's where we dig into it. And it takes someone, you know, I'm 32 years into recovery. It takes what it takes to peel off the layers to help find what is blocking our true growth.
And Donna, I had a male client 3 weeks ago in session coaching, and I either through the Holy Spirit serendipitously or stupidly somehow, not stupidly, but we were talking, but this guy had uncovered trauma that had happened to him at age 6 or 7, and I'm not that guy. I mean, I am not the kind of go get them gestalt, let's go find the trauma,
right,
you know, Roy Rogers guy, and I actually unearthed a treasure trove. We got the guy in some EMDR, you know,
right,
counseling to quickly address the anxiety and the trauma. Very, very, very EMDR does that so much faster than I could in talk therapy. And and we got this guy to a better place, but really fast. We had to, because the coaching situation that he's in with his business, we had to get him up and running and going as quick as we could. But anyhow, wow. So I like that, Donna, because you're saying many times people that are stuck in their recovery they're sitting on things that they haven't even discovered yet, similar to what you did. So I hear Justin back there. So
yeah, and Bruce,
please, go ahead.
Well, and what she said is so true, because let's think about it. We're talking about rewiring of our subconscious, and your subconscious, you know, and really your brain is a deletion, distortion, and generalization device. That's it. Mm-hmm. That's what it's designed for. So
self-protection.
It's no surprise. Yeah, protection.
Right.
Yep. So it's no surprise that sometimes it takes people, you know, months, years, decades even to even get at the root of what that trauma was. So I love that you brought that up, Donna, because it's something that people don't really think about. They think they're okay. They think they got it. And it's like, there might be something much deeper there. But it just might take some time to really get at it. And as you said, peel back the layers of the onion.
Right. As you said earlier, Justin, you said root causes and problems. That's what you said about your coaching earlier, because I wrote that down when you said that's what we do as coaches. You know, and it's like we said, we don't always know what is defeating us until we slowly get, and we get blocked. We just get blocked. I know personally, I went through a blockage myself, and sometimes we all have our own mentors. I have my own mentor. I have a wonderful lady by the name of Mary, and she helped me recently get through a block, because I can't see myself as other people see me. I, as a coach, have to run my stuff through someone else. Because sometimes even my own perception isn't good.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You need that third party feedback, you know.
Right. Right. So we all need that check.
We absolutely do.
Right.
Well, since how is your family dealing with you, you know, coming forward with this and your book and the media, and how are your close family members handling that?
So obviously I've had quite a bit of media come out.
Yes, a lot.
Well, I wouldn't have come forward, especially with the Cosby story, had my parents not passed.
Okay.
Yes, that would have broke both my parents' heart. I was very, very close with my parents when they passed in the last 10 years, as well as my sisters and the rest of my family members. I had an article written in a interview online called Medium. A lot of people are familiar with that. And I had it published the day that Bill Cosby was prosecuted. And I sent it to my family. They had no idea about what had happened between Bill and I. And I sent it to them in a link. And that was the first time they had heard about it ever. So they had no idea. No one had any idea.
Were they supportive? Were they, how were
they were forward? Shocked at first.
Yes. At first.
And then, of course, they've been very, very supportive. They've been supportive from day one. When the news broke about Bill originally, what was it, like 4 years ago, 3-4 years ago, there were some people that knew about what had happened between him and I. And I was honestly afraid that someone would sell my story out because some people knew I was a minor. But I was grateful they didn't. And then a lot of people after my story came out kind of was like, well, why didn't you get with all the other women? Why didn't you come out then? Why weren't you, why didn't you sue them? Why didn't? And, you know, the reason I waited was because my story is different than a lot of those women. He didn't drug me that I know of. You know, I was drinking very heavily. There are times I do recall not remembering sleeping. I don't remember going to sleep or coming to. Do you know what I mean? It's pretty blurry, and it was a very long time ago. And I wanted to tell my story on my terms. And I didn't sue him for a couple of reasons, not that you asked, but I'm going to tell you anyway. first of all, there's not an amount of money that is going to replace what happened. And it's not like I'm making a ton of money from this book anyway. But that's one reason. And also what a lot of people really don't know about Bill is that he's extremely a vindictive individual. I mean, downright nasty, vindictive individual.
Okay. Okay.
And I didn't care to get into a lawsuit with him.
I see.
And so by waiting until he was literally locked up and put in jail is what
right.
I came to speak. I mean, not the day that they said guilty, but the day he had handcuffs and was put away was when I said
right.
It was like right. I was safe.
Okay. Understood. And that makes total sense. I mean, you know what? I agree with the way you handle it. You get to control the narrative.
Right.
You're only talking about your story. You're not, like you said, you're not attaching it to some sort of a civil lawsuit or other broad-based civil action, nor
right.
are you identifying with clusters of other victims who may have had God knows what kind of story, you know, to them.
Right.
So you get to maintain your identity. Your personal identity, and go through this process, and you're right, you know, and I do want to say that just because we publish a book and maybe even do speaking afterwards does not mean by any stretch of the imagination that person is making a ton of money. You're not. You're working
Mm-mm.
your ass off. You're mm-hmm. you're traveling. You're hustling. I know you have your media person blowing and going. You're blowing and going. You're up there texting me this morning. I mean, you were. I'm like, okay, lady. You know, so you're up
right.
early California time,
right.
waking me up, saying, telling me what to do. That was good. So, no, I mean, you're out there, you're working and doing the deal. And this is, yeah, this is by no means. I know one of the questions people have asked you is about your calling, as an actress and other things. And, you're laughing, right?
That's okay.
But certainly, what would you say your calling is at this point?
Well, first of all, I never had the calling as an actress or a model. That was never. If you ever saw my movies, you know I can't act. I'll be the first to admit. I don't even know how I ever got a job as an actress. That still cracks me up to this day. I mean, I can't act my way out of a paper bag. My honest calling is to help other people, preferably women, because that's who I relate most to. I am really a girl's girl, but to help women, to help women get sober or work through some of their issues so they don't have to die from drug abuse and alcoholism, for one. And if there's anything I can do to walk them through that in any sort of fashion, I'm willing to do that, however that looks.
Excellent.
And the second one is to help them come into some sort of light with any sort of sexual abuse issue that they have. Right down to if it's listening and finding a certain channel to where they need to go to find the help that they need.
Right. Absolutely.
And in regards to helping them so they don't have to self-harm and whatever that looks like around that, and guiding them to the place they need to go regarding that. I never thought, I'll be honest with you, Bruce, that I would be an advocate for sexual abuse, because I never looked at myself as a victim of sexual abuse until I wrote this book. And I don't even really look at myself as a victim or a survivor of sexual abuse, as I look at myself as a person who has a message to share with other women so they don't have to hurt.
Yeah. Yeah. And honestly, at the end of the day, probably anywhere from 24 to 29% of women over the age of 24 are survivors of some sort of sexual,
Right.
I mean, right. Just
of some way or form. Yeah. And it's absolutely amazing. Mm-hmm. It's really, really amazing. And, it's interesting right now on Instagram, I get a lot of personal messages, and I get them from men and women of sexual abuse, men and women. Mm-hmm. And they just keep coming forward going, Donna, thank you for your message. Thank you for your message. I was this, and it stopped me from being a Marine because of sexual abuse. I was this and this and this sexual abuse and this and this and this. And I say, seek help. Go here. Do this, do that, but don't hide anymore. Don't hide. Come out, and it's okay. It's okay. If anything else.
And boy, just what a great feeling, and also what a great opportunity that this is for so many people that you're reaching, through your book and social media, and even this program to a lesser extent, that we'll be able to hopefully get your book, or at a minimum, receive coaching from you, or go to your websites. We'll talk about those in a few minutes, and be able to be empowered, by your story, and how you did it. And, that's your witness, that's your testimony. Nobody can take that away. And yet I feel sure, many, many people will be empowered by it.
I hope so. I never thought in a million years that this is what I'd be doing. I went from this zany model running around the Playboy Mansion to being on Concierge Coaches with Justin and Bruce today. I never would have guessed that in a million years. In a million years. that wasn't how I pictured this, my life at 55.
I imagine that I have that picture of you with Hefner and all the ladies, and I still
right.
Are, but nor would I at 56 ever have a picture of Hugh Hefner and all the ladies. And I know I've been to Brentwood. There's actually a sober living house not too far from the Playboy Mansion, or one of them out there, and And I didn't even know it was around there until somebody, one of the residents, told me. But yeah, nor would I even think I'd be doing this either. But that's great, and I'm so glad that we're both here, Don.
Yeah, absolutely. Here
and we're kind of
doing the right thing.
Yeah,
the right thing. I got to tell you, there were a lot of years I didn't do the next right thing.
Right,
a lot of years.
Got to do the make the next right decision. Well, I know we got about 2 minutes left, Justin. Do you have any questions?
I think she did. First of all, Donna, thanks for coming on and being so candid with your story. It's not easy to be vulnerable, to be candid, but I think, you know, those that are strong enough and courageous enough to do so, there's a lot of people that benefit clearly. And have been, you know, from your story. So thank you for that. Mm-hmm. That was a really powerful message that I know a lot of our listeners are going to love and hopefully have lots of comments and direct messages and follow-up questions for you following the show. So thank you. Really great stuff today.
Oh, thank you, Justin. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to share my story with you.
Absolutely. And folks, please get Donna's book, Naked Truth, The Rise and Fall of Donna Spear. It's available on Amazon, also recoverycoachingexperts.com or at donnaspear.com. And please go by the donnaspear.com. That's DonnaSpeir.com or recoverycoachingexperts.com. And Donna, what is your, do you want to announce your either Facebook or Instagrams that folks can follow?
Yeah, I'm at Donna Spear, DonnaSpeir 2222. That's my lucky number. I don't know where that came from on Instagram. I know, right? And I am at Donna Spear on Facebook, DonnaSpeir. You can follow me on Facebook there as well. And Bruce and Justin, one more time, thank you so much for allowing me to be your guest today on Concierge Coaches Show. It was my pleasure.
Absolutely, our pleasure as well. And perhaps we can have you come on again sometime. I know Justin and I get feedback and questions, and we may have you come back here for a check-in and see how things are going and possibly, you know, where you're at with either speaking or other engagements. It'll be fun to track your career moving forward. So, well, folks, that was another great episode of the Concierge Coaches Show. Please see us on Facebook. We are also on Instagram as well, The Concierge Coaches, on LinkedIn at The Concierge Coaches, and follow us on Apple Podcasts. We are there as well. Also, the shows are archived on the LA Talk Radio site on our page, the Concierge Coaches page. So with that, we'll bid everybody a great week, and we'll see everyone here next week on the Concierge Coaches Show on LA Talk Radio. Have a blessed week, everybody.
You're listening to the Concierge Coaches Show with Bruce Cameron and Justin Nimmergood, only on LA Talk Radio.